Whence things have their origin, thence also their destruction happens, as is the order of things. For they execute the sentence upon one another, the condemnation of the crime, in conformity with the ordinance of time. Anaximander's quote might have been meant for today. Our world is changing rapidly, with our future in the balance. Our global population has grown to 7 billion and continues to rise. We're eating away at our supplies of energy, water, fertile land, minerals. We're spoiling our environment and driving species extinct every day. We're caught up in financial and political crises entirely of our own creation. Sometimes it feels as if all the technological progress on which we have built our lives and our societies is just leading us toward disaster. There's an overwhelming sense that we are running out of time. Our personal capabilities have never been greater. Many of us can now communicate instantly with collaborators, friends, and family around the globe. This ability has powered new democratic movements, like those of the Arab Spring, and has allowed the assembly of great stores of collectively curated information like Wikipedia. It is driving global scientific collaborations and opening online access to quality educational materials and lectures for people everywhere. But the internet, with all of its attractions, is also profoundly dehumanizing. Increasingly, we are glued to our computers and smartphones, building our social and professional lives around email, social media, blogs, or tweets. Overload of digital information turns us into automata, workaholics, passive consumers. Its harsh physical form stresses us and creates a mismatch between our own human nature and the manner in which we're being forced to communicate. Our analog nature is being compressed into a digital stream. Not so surprising, then, that as comedian Louis C.K. recently put it, everything is amazing right now, and nobody's happy. Huge economic and political shifts are also taking place. Past political paradigms are becoming irrelevant, with Western governments intervening massively to shore up their financial systems, and communist-led China overseeing the world's greatest market-driven boom. The digital revolution has spawned companies built on information, like Google, Amazon, and Facebook. Instead of the old worker-owner divide, society is developing a new fracture between an economically active elite and a marginalized remainder. Short-term thinking is endemic, as is natural when things are moving fast. It is as if we are driving a speeding car through a fog, swerving to avoid potholes, roadblocks, or oncoming vehicles, anxiously anticipating dangers with no power to predict them. Politicians tend to think no further than the next election, investors the next twist or turn in the market, scientists no further than the next grant. In this lecture, I want to talk about the future of this world of ours. The coming century will see our lives and those of our children transformed. What happens will depend on the decisions we take and on the discoveries we make. I won't make any forecasts, nor will I try to outline a plan for our survival, although that is a vital, pragmatic task requiring the skills and dedication of many people. Instead, I want to try to step back from all the anxieties and the immediate issues of today and address something much more basic and long-term, namely our own human character and how coming technological progress may change our very nature. Speaking about the future makes us nervous. Einstein said, "I never think of the future. It comes soon enough." We cannot predict what will happen, nor do we know what we are capable of. I feel like a diver standing on the edge of a tall cliff, peering over the precipice and into the fog below. Is there a beautiful, cool ocean waiting for me, or only jagged rocks? I don't know. Nevertheless, I will take the plunge. Scientific advances we can now envisage may bring us, as living, self-conscious beings, much closer to physical reality. The separation of our ideas from our nature, of science from society, of our intellect from our feelings, and of ourselves from the universe may diminish. Not only might we see the universe more clearly, but we may come to know it more deeply. And in time, that knowledge will change who we are. This is an extraordinary prospect, which I hope will encourage us to see our way to a bright future. Thinking about the universe might seem like escapism or a luxury. How will it solve the problem of world hunger or carbon emissions or the national debt? But throughout history, from Anaximander and Pythagoras to Galileo and Newton, the universe has been very good at teaching us things, inspiring us to rise above our current circumstances and see what lies beyond. Over the course of the 20th century, physics produced a working mathematical model of all known forces and particles in nature, tested to a precision unmatched in any other scientific field. The learning continues at the most powerful ever microscope, the Large Hadron Collider at CERN in Geneva, and the most powerful ever telescope, the European Space Agency's Planck satellite, which is now overhead. In recent years, we have learned that the vacuum, so-called empty space, is actually very far from empty. Even if you clear away all of the particles, fields, and radiation, space is full of uniformly spread energy, known as the vacuum energy, or dark energy, because we cannot see it. It comprises nearly 3/4 of all the energy in the universe, and that fraction is rising because its repulsive gravitational force is speeding the expansion of the universe and diluting everything else away. In the coming tens of billions of years, this expansion, driven by vacuum energy, will carry the 100 billion galaxies we now see away from us and beyond our view. If the vacuum energy persists, the far future will be cold and dark, quite literally vacuous. If it decays, it may cause the next Big Bang. As Anaximander said, our world is transitory, and the physical forces that enabled its emergence are now in the process of taking it away. We have recently learned that all of space is permeated with the Higgs field, which endows all the particles and fields we are made of with their distinct properties. The Higgs bosons, recently discovered at the Large Hadron Collider, are like tiny ripples in the Higgs field. And as we probe the Higgs field, we are discovering the makeup of the vacuum. And we are finding clues as to exactly what happened at the Big Bang. The Big Bang involved physical processes on the tiniest imaginable distance, a billion billion times smaller than an atomic nucleus, the scale on which space-time itself becomes quantum. By observing what came out of the Big Bang, we can learn how the universe works on this minuscule scale. Likewise, by observing the universe on the very largest scales we can probe, set by the vacuum energy, we are learning about what is in the vacuum and how it will affect our future. The universe seems at its simplest on these very smallest and very largest length scales. It may be no coincidence that the size of a living cell is the geometric mean of the smallest and largest lengths in the cosmos. This is the scale of life, the realm we inhabit, and it is the scale of maximum complexity in the universe. And on this in-between scale, some of the most important and exciting progress in physics is now taking place. We're beginning to understand the intricate properties of quantum matter, which may soon allow us to build quantum computers, quantum communication systems, and quantum sensors, which could transform our abilities to experience and understand the world. So these are the three frontiers for 21st century physics: the emergence of the universe at the Big Bang, the vacuum energy and its ultimate fate, and the quantum behavior of matter on human scales. Remarkably, the same mathematical tools and ideas which allow us to describe gravity and energy in the universe are helping us to understand the quantum world and to design new quantum materials. The universe continues to teach us things with which we can shape the technologies of tomorrow. Our society has reached a critical moment. Our capacity to generate and access information has grown to the point where we're in danger of overwhelming ourselves with it. We are being deluged with information through electrical signals and radio waves, reduced to a digital, superliteral form that can be distributed and reproduced at almost no cost. The technology makes no distinction between junk and value, and it removes us from our own nature as complex, unpredictable, passionate people. The ultraviolet catastrophe, which classical physics encountered at the end of the 19th century, serves as a metaphor. James Clerk Maxwell's theory of electromagnetic radiation and light was a triumph, being the most beautiful and powerful application of mathematics to reality. Yet it implied that there were waves of all wavelengths, from zero to infinity. In any real context where heat and electromagnetic energy are constantly being exchanged between objects, this feature of Maxwell's theory led to a disaster. Any hot object could radiate energy into the very shortest ultraviolet wavelengths of light at an unlimited rate, leading to a disastrous instability of the world. This disaster led Max Planck and Albert Einstein to the hypothesis that light carries energy only in packets or quanta. Quantum theory eventually forced us to abandon all hopes of a classical, mechanical picture of the world as envisaged by Newton, Maxwell, and Einstein himself. We have had to give up the idea of space and time as a definite arena inhabited by definite entities in the form of particles and waves. Instead, we had to reconceive the world in a far more abstract, all-encompassing view called quantum theory, which reduced our capacity to know or visualize nature, while giving us a powerful new mathematical means of analyzing and predicting it. Our society has been shaped by physics' past discoveries to an extent that is seldom appreciated. The mechanical world of Newton led to mechanical ways of learning, as well as to the modern industrial age. Quantum physics led to the invention of the transistor, which enabled the digital revolution now transforming our lives. Computers are filling our schools and offices, replacing factory workers, miners, and farmers. They are changing the way we work, learn, live, and think. Earlier in this series, I talked about the extraordinary power of quantum computers and what they might do. Classical computers store information in its crudest, simplest possible form, strings of bits which can be either zero or one. As powerful as computers are, that is all they contain. However, quantum physics has taught us that nature does not work this way. The smallest possible unit of information in the natural world, the quantum world, for example, the information contained in the spin of a single electron, is a quantum bit or qubit. Just one qubit is infinitely richer than a classical bit, or any number of classical bits, because it's specified by continuous numbers. Roughly speaking, a qubit can be both zero and one at the same time. But more accurately, comparing a bit with a qubit is like comparing the information contained in an on-off switch with that in the position of a star on the sky. Just one qubit contains more information than any number of classical bits, and as we put more and more qubits together, the difference from classical information grows exponentially. Just 300 qubits collectively store more information than could be stored classically in the position of every single particle in the entire visible universe. What will this vast increase in our information gathering and handling capabilities mean? It is striking to compare our situation today with vast libraries at our fingertips and far vaster ones to come with that of the authors of the modern scientific age. In the Wren Library in Trinity College, Cambridge, Isaac Newton's personal library consists of a few hundred books, occupying a single bookcase. That was quite enough to allow him to found modern physics and mathematical science. A short walk away, in the main university library, Charles Darwin's personal library is also preserved. His entire collection of books occupies a 10-meter stretch of shelving. Again, for one of the most profound and original thinkers in history, it is a minuscule collection. Today, on your smartphone, you can access information resources greater than in any library. According to Moore's law, in a couple of decades, your laptop will comfortably hold every single book that has ever been written. A laptop quantum computer will seem more like Jorge Luis Borges's Library of Babel, a fantastical collection holding every possible ordering of letters and words in a book, and therefore every book that could ever be written. This would in fact be the capability of a quantum computer. One could imagine searching for all possible interesting passages of writing without anyone having had to compose them. I would never have had to write the messy lectures. Quantum sensors, communication channels, and computers may allow us to collect and process vast amounts of information on ourselves and on our environment. For example, we could detect and track the concentrations of organic molecules and other chemicals, constantly analyzing their presence. Such capabilities would revolutionize our ability to monitor and to understand our own health, as well as that of other living species. With access to such vast amounts of data, our ability to take care of ourselves and our natural environment would be transformed. It is important to realize that there is nothing intrinsically dangerous or expensive about quantum technologies. Every single object around us, made of atoms and molecules, functions in fully quantum ways. In accessing and utilizing quantum phenomena, all we are doing is bringing our experiences closer to nature and how it actually works. By far the greatest impact quantum computers will have is likely to be on ourselves. The idea that our communication technologies change us was emphasized by Canadian communications guru Marshall McLuhan. McLuhan's 1964 book, Understanding Media, the Extensions of Man, kicked off a wave of interest in the uses of mass media in all forms, from pop music to television. McLuhan's writing is more poetic than analytical, but his basic insight was that the information content of all of these forms of mass media, from ads to games, cars, typewriters, remember no PCs then, to books, telephones, newspapers, and so on, is less important than their physical form and their direct hold on our behavior. He summed up this idea in his famous aphorism, "The medium is the message." Today, watching people wander around, eyes glued to smartphones, texting or emailing, in the grip of their gadgets, and nearly oblivious to their surroundings, you can see exactly what he meant. McLuhan's point was that media have been having this effect on us for millennia. If you think for 2 seconds, it's amazing and faintly ridiculous that the mere act of compressing and so severely limiting our ideas in writing, in the case of European languages, into words written in an alphabet of 26 letters, has proven to be such a powerful and society-dominating technology. The process of committing ourselves to texts, from the scriptures to textbooks, encyclopedias, novels, political pamphlets, laws, and contracts, and then allowing them to control our lives, has had an enormous and undeniable effect on who we are. McLuhan argued that print altered our entire outlook, emphasizing our visual sense above our other senses, thus influencing the fragmentation and specialization of knowledge, and fostering everything, he claimed, from individualism to bureaucracy to nationalistic wars, peptic ulcers, and pornography. McLuhan saw all media, whether print, photography, radio, or TV, in a similar way, as an extension of our own nervous system, dramatically altering our nature and hence our society. Quote, "We have never stopped drastically interfering with ourselves by every technology we could latch on to," he said, in The Future of Man in the Electric Age. "We have absolutely disrupted our lives over and over again." McLuhan accurately foresaw that electronic media would be combined with computers to spread information cheaply and instantly around the world in a variety of forms. 30 years before the internet was launched, he wrote, "The next medium, whatever it It may be the extension of consciousness will include television as its content, not as its environment, and will transform television into an art form. A computer as a research and communication instrument could enhance retrieval, obsolesce mass library organization, retrieve the individual's encyclopedic function, and flip into a private line to speedily tailor data of a saleable kind. And that was in the early 60s. Furthermore, McLuhan argued optimistically that we might regain the breadth of our senses, which the printed word has diminished, restoring the pre-literate tribal balance between all of our senses through a unified, seamless web of experience. As electronic communication connected us, the world would become a global village, another of McLuhan's famous catchphrases. McLuhan owed a pronounced intellectual debt to a visionary and mystic who came before him, Pierre Teilhard de Chardin, a Jesuit priest, geologist, and paleontologist who played a role in the discovery of Peking Man. Teilhard took a very big picture view of the universe and our place within it, a picture that encompassed and motivated some of McLuhan's major insights. Teilhard also foresaw global communications and the internet, writing in the 1950s about, quote, the extraordinary network of radio and television communication, which already link us all in a sort of etherized human consciousness, unquote. And, quote, those astonishing electronic computers which enhance the speed of thought and pave the way for a revolution in the speed of research, unquote. This technology, he wrote, was creating a, quote, nervous system for humanity, a, quote, stupendous thinking machine. The age of civilization has ended, he said, and the age of one civilization is beginning. These ideas were an extension of Teilhard's magnum opus, The Phenomenon of Man. He completed the manuscript in the late 1930s, but because of his heterodox views, his ecclesiastical order refused throughout his lifetime to permit him to publish any of his writings. So Teilhard's books and many collections of his essays were only published after his death in 1955. In spite of being a Catholic priest, Teilhard accepted Darwinian evolution as a fact, and he built his futuristic vision around it. He saw the physical universe as in a state of constant evolution. Indeed, the phenomenon of man presents a, quote, history of the universe, unquote, in terms that are surprisingly modern. Teilhard was probably influenced in this by another Jesuit priest, the founder of the hot Big Bang cosmology, Georges Lemaître. Teilhard describes the emergence of complexity in the universe from particles to atoms to molecules to stars and planets, complex molecules, living cells, and consciousness as a progressive involution of matter and energy, during which the universe becomes increasingly self-aware. Humans are of fundamental significance to the whole. Teilhard quotes with approval Julian Huxley, who stated that, quote, man discovers that he is nothing else than evolution become conscious of itself, unquote. Huxley was the grandson of T.H. Huxley, the biologist famously known as Darwin's bulldog, for his articulate defense of evolutionary theory in the 19th century. And Julian Huxley was one of the founders of the modern evolutionary synthesis, linking genetics to evolution. Teilhard took Huxley's statement to a cosmic scale, envisaging that human society confined to the Earth's spherical surface would become increasingly connected into what would be, in effect, a very large living cell. With its self-consciousness and its inventions, it would continue to evolve through non-biological means, towards an ultimate state of universal awareness, which he called the omega point. Teilhard's arguments are vague, elusive, and despite his claims, necessarily unscientific, since many key steps, such as the formation of cells and life and the emergence of consciousness, are well beyond our scientific understanding, as of course is the future. His vision is nonetheless interesting for the way in which it sees in evolution a latent potential for progress towards increasing complexity within the physical substance of the world. This potential is becoming increasingly evident as human advancement through technology and collaboration supersedes survival of the biologically fittest as the driver of evolutionary progress. As Huxley says in his introduction to Teilhard's book, quote, "We, mankind, contain the possibilities of the Earth's immense future and can realize more and more of them on condition that we increase our knowledge and our love." That, it seems to me, is the distillation of the phenomenon of man, unquote. McLuhan and Teilhard accurately foresaw the digital age and the future impact of electronic communication on the evolution of society. As McLuhan put it, the medium or process of our time, electric technology, is reshaping and restructuring patterns of our social interdependence and every aspect of our personal life. Everything is changing. You, your family, your neighborhood, your job, your government, your relation to, quote, the others, and they're changing dramatically, unquote. He also foresaw some of the features and dangers of the internet and social media. He described what he called an electrically computerized dossier bank, that one big gossip column that is unforgiving, unforgetful, and from which there is no redemption, no erasure of early mistakes. Quite amazing in the 1960s. These comments are insightful. They point to the clash between digital information and our analog nature. Our bodies and our senses work in smooth, continuous ways, and we most appreciate music or art or natural experiences that incorporate rich, continuous textures. We are analog beings living in a digital world, facing a quantum future. At the beginning of the 20th century, the smallest piece of matter we knew about was the atom, and the largest was our galaxy. Over the subsequent century, we have extended our view of the universe down to a billionth the size of an atom and 100,000 times the size of our galaxy. With experiments like the Large Hadron Collider and the Planck satellite, we are reaching for the inner and outer limits of the universe. But at least as significant, with studies of quantum matter, we are revealing the organization of entangled levels of reality, more subtle than anything so far seen. If history is any guide, these discoveries will spawn new technologies that will change our society. Since the 1960s, the evolution of digital computers has been inexorable. Moore's law has allowed them to shrink and move progressively closer to our heads, from freezer-sized cabinets to desktops to laptops to smartphones held in our hands. And Google has just announced Project Glass, a pair of spectacles incorporating a fully capable computer screen. With the screen right next to your eye, the power requirements are tiny and the system can be super efficient. No doubt the trend will continue and computers will become more and more an integral part of our lives, our bodies, and ourselves. Having access to vast stores of digital information and processing power is changing our society and our nature. But Moore's law will come to an end a decade or so from now, as transistors approach the ultimate limit set by the size of the atom. When that happens, our digital technology will have to be replaced by quantum technologies whose operations reflect far more closely those of the natural world. Digital information is the crudest, bluntest form of information there is. Supplementing ourselves with more and more of it, as we are doing today, is in this sense evolutionarily regressive. Digital information's strongest feature is that it is easily read and translated and copied cheaply and accurately, but it represents a reduction of analog information, the dead blueprint or memory of life, rather than life itself. On the other hand, quantum information is infinitely deeper, more subtle and delicate, even than the analog information familiar to us. Interacting with it will represent a giant leap forward, bringing us much closer to the natural world and how it operates all around us. But the flip side is that quantum information is extremely fragile. As powerful and all-aware as it is, according to the laws of quantum physics, quantum information cannot be replicated, a result known as the no-cloning theorem. Unlike classical computers or our genes, quantum computers will not be able to create multiple copies of themselves. Without us, or at least some classical partner, they will not be able to evolve. So it seems that a relationship between ourselves as analog beings and quantum computers may be of great mutual benefit, and it may represent the next leap forward for evolution and for life. We shall provide the definiteness and persistence, while quantum computers embody the more exploratory, flighty, and wide-ranging component. We will ask the questions, and the quantum computer will know the answers. Just as our digital genes encode our analog operations, we, or our evolutionary successors, shall be the operating system of quantum life. In the same way our DNA is surrounded by analog machinery which brings it to life, we will presumably become surrounded by quantum computers, making us even more aware of the universe. The most successful combinations of people and quantum computers and devices will propagate and multiply. With their vast information collecting and processing capacities, quantum devices may be able to monitor, repair, or even renew our bodies. They may allow us to run smart systems to ensure that energy and natural resources are utilized wisely. They may help us to design and oversee the production of new materials like carbon fibers for space elevators and antimatter technologies for space propulsion. Quantum life would seem to have all the qualities needed to explore and understand the universe. While the possibility of a coming quantum age is exciting, nothing is guaranteed. The future will be what we make of it. For a sharp dose of pessimism, let us turn to a remarkable woman whose main targets were the romantic notions of her age, the Victorian age of wonder and exploration. Mary Shelley was the daughter of one of the first feminists, Mary Wollstonecraft, a philosopher, educator, and the author in 1792 of A Vindication of the Rights of Women. Mary Shelley's father was William Godwin, a radical political philosopher. During childbirth, Mary Wollstonecraft contracted a bacterial infection and she died soon after. Throughout her life, Mary Shelley continued to revere her mother. She was raised by her father, and when 16 years old, she became involved with Percy Bysshe Shelley, one of England's most famous romantic poets. Percy was already married, and their relationship caused a great scandal. After his first wife committed suicide, Percy married Mary. They had four children, two before they were married, although only the last survived. The first was premature and died quickly. The second died of dysentery, and the third of malaria, both during their parents' travels in Italy. Mary started writing Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, its subtitle, on one of her journeys to the continent with Percy when she was only 18. It was published anonymously, although with a preface by Percy, when Mary was 21. Now recognized as one of the earliest works of science fiction, Frankenstein provides a compelling warning about the seductions and dangers of science. Shelley's reference to Prometheus shows the still persistent influence of the ancient Greek myths on the most forward thinkers of the time. Contemporary science set the background for the novel. In November 1806, the British chemist Sir Humphry Davy gave the Bakerian lecture at the Royal Society in London. His topic was electricity and electrochemical analysis. In his introduction, he said, "It will be seen that Volta, the inventor of the battery, has presented to us a key that promises to lay open some of the most mysterious recesses of nature. There is now before us a boundless prospect of novelty in science, a country unexplored, but noble and fertile in aspect, a land of promise in philosophy." So I'm in good company. Public demonstrations and experiments were very popular in London at this time, A particularly notorious example was an attempt by another Italian, Giovanni Aldini, professor of anatomy at Bologna, to revive the body of a murderer 6 hours after he had been hanged. Aldini's demonstrations were breathlessly reported in the press. On the first application of the, quote, on the first application of the electrical arcs, the jaw began to quiver, the adjoining muscles were horribly contorted, and the left eye actually opened. Vitality might have been fully restored if many ulterior circumstances had not rendered this inappropriate. I think science has progressed a little bit. Mary Shelley was likely inspired by events like these and the general fascination with science to write Frankenstein. Her novel captures the intensity and focus of a young scientist, Dr. Victor Frankenstein, on the track of solving a great mystery. Quote, after days and nights of incredible labor and fatigue, I succeeded in discovering the cause of generation and life. Nay, more, I became myself capable of bestowing animation upon lifeless matter. Overwhelmed with the exhilaration of his finding, he states, what had been the study and desire of the wisest men since the creation of the world was now within my grasp. His success encourages him to press on. My imagination was too much exalted by my first success to permit me to doubt of my ability to give life to an animal as complex and wonderful as man. Without any thought of the possible dangers, Frankenstein creates a monster whose need for companionship he cannot satisfy. The monster eventually exacts his revenge by murdering Frankenstein's new bride. In 1822, 4 years after Frankenstein appeared, Percy Shelley was drowned in a sailboat accident off Italy. 4 years after that, Mary published her fourth novel, The Last Man. Amazingly enough, it foretells the end of all humankind in 2100. As a result of a plague, it is a damning critique of man's romantic notions of his own power to control his destiny. An early scene describes how, after an election, a new Lord Protector is appointed in England. Quote, Raymond was occupied in 1,000 beneficial schemes. He was continually surrounded by projectors and projects which were to render England one scene of fertility and magnificence. The state of poverty was to be abolished. Men were to be transported from place to place almost with the same facility as the princes in the Arabian Nights. But before any of these plans become realized, a war between Greece and Turkey draws England in, and its hero, Raymond, is killed in Constantinople. One of the leading figures, Adrian, states of the new peace, "Let this last but 12 months, and earth will become a paradise. The energies of man were before directed at the destruction of his species. Now they aim at its liberation and preservation. Man cannot repose, and his restless aspirations will now bring forth good instead of evil. The favored countries of the South will throw off the iron yoke of servitude. Poverty will quit us, and with that, sickness. What may not the forces, never before united, of liberty and peace achieve in this dwelling of man?" But Adrian's dreams are also soon shattered. A plague is rapidly spreading west from Constantinople, and people come flooding into England from Greece, Italy, and France. Raymond's dithering successor flees his position as the plague enters London. And the romantic Adrian assumes command. But instead of dealing with the crisis, he tries to pretend that there is no plague. Eventually, the truth becomes obvious, and Adrian has no choice but to lead the population out of England onto the continent, where they slowly and painfully die. Finally, the last survivor, Vernie, sails off around the world, echoing Percy Shelley's fate. He says, "I form no expectation of alteration for the better, but the monotonous is intolerable to me. Neither hope nor joy are my pilots. Restless despair and fierce desire of change lead me on. I long to grapple with danger, to be excited by fear, to have some task, however slight or voluntary, for each day's fulfillment. The irony is palpable. The Last Man was received poorly on its publication and was forgotten for 1.5 centuries, but it has recently come to be seen as one of Shelley's major works. Well, nearly 2 centuries have passed since Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein. The monster she envisaged Dr. Frankenstein creating has not materialized, nor so far have uncontrollable diseases like the plague in The Last Man. Nevertheless, the dangers she speaks about are as relevant as ever. In spite of revolutionary inventions in medicine, from vaccines to antiretrovirals, there continue to be a vast number of deaths from preventable causes. The only guarantee of progress is a continued commitment to humane principles and to the view that science should serve society's needs. Many scientists express the pessimistic viewpoint that the universe seems pointless at a deep level, and that our situation is somehow tragic. For myself, I find this position hard to understand. Merely to be alive, to experience and to appreciate the wonder of the universe, and to be able to share it with others, is a miracle. I can only think that it is the separation of scientists from society caused by the focus and intensity of their research that leads them to be so dismissive of other aspects of human existence. Of course, taking the view that the universe seems pointless is also a convenient way for scientists to eliminate, as far as possible, any prior prejudices or ulterior motives from their research. They want to figure out how things work without being swayed by any thoughts of why they might work that way. It is reasonable to postpone questions of purpose when we have no scientific means of answering them. But to deny such influences is not to deal with them. Scientists are very often consciously or unconsciously driven by agendas well outside science, even if they do not acknowledge them. Many people outside science are interested in exactly the questions that scientists prefer to avoid. They want to know what scientific discoveries mean. In the case of cosmology, why the universe exists and why we are here. I think that if science is to overcome the disconnection with society, it needs to be better able to explain science's greatest lesson, that for the purposes of advancing our knowledge, it is extremely important to doubt constantly and to live with uncertainty. Richard Feynman put it this way: this attitude of mind, this attitude of uncertainty, is vital to the scientist. And it is this attitude of mind which the student must first acquire. It becomes a habit of thought. Once acquired, we cannot retreat from it anymore. In today's soundbite world, intellectual modesty and being frank about uncertainty are not the easiest things to promote. Nevertheless, I suspect scientists will become more, not less, credible if they do so, and society will feel less alienated from science. My own view is that science should absolutely be about serving society's needs. Society needs to better understand science and to see its value beyond just providing the next gadget or technical solution. Science should be a part of fulfilling society's goals and creating the kind of world we would like to inhabit. Building the future is not only about servicing our needs, although those are important. There's an inspirational aspect of science and of understanding our place in the universe, which enriches society and art and music and literature and everything else. Science, in its turn, becomes more creative and fruitful when it is challenged to explain what it is doing and why, and when scientists better appreciate the importance of their work to wider society. Ever since the ancient Greeks, science has well appreciated that a free exchange of ideas in which we are constantly trying out new theories while always remaining open to being proved wrong is the best way to make progress. Within the scientific community, a new student can question the most senior professor and authority is never, or should never be, acceptable as an argument. If our ideas are any good, it does not matter where they come from, they must stand on their own. Science is profoundly democratic in this sense. While its driver is often individual genius or insight, it engenders a strong sense of common cause and humility among its practitioners. These ways of thinking and behaving are valuable well beyond the borders of science. However, as science has grown, it has also become increasingly specialized. To quote Richard Feynman again, there are too few people who have such a deep understanding of two departments of our knowledge that they do not make fools of themselves in one or the other. And as science grows and fragments, it becomes less accessible both to other scientists and to the general public. Opportunities for cross-fertilization are missed. Scientists lose their sense of wider purpose, and their science is reduced either to a self-serving academic exercise or a purely technical task, while most of society remains ignorant of science's great promise and fundamental importance to our future. There are ways of overcoming this problem of disconnection, and they are becoming increasingly important. I am fortunate to live in a very unusual community in Canada with a high level of public interest in science. Every month, our institute holds a public lecture on physics in the local high school in a hall with a capacity of 650. Month in and month out, the lectures are packed with all the tickets sold out. How did this happen? The key, I believe, is simply respect. When scientists make a serious attempt to explain what they are doing and why, it isn't hard to get people excited. There are many benefits for the public. It's a chance to learn firsthand from experts about cutting-edge research. And for scientists, it is energizing to explain your ideas to non-specialists. It forces you to think them through and extract the really important ideas from the technicalities. It is deeply energizing to realize that people outside your technical specialty actually care about what you are doing. And finally, and most importantly, an exciting lecture can inspire young people and help them choose their future life path. Throughout these lectures, I emphasize special people, places, and times that produced profound progress, like ancient Greece, where a great flowering of science, philosophy, art, and literature went hand in hand with new ways of organizing society. The philosopher Epicurus, for example, seems in some respects to have anticipated the arguments of Galileo, that nothing should be believed without being tested through direct observation and logical deduction. In other words, the scientific method. Epicurus is also credited with the ethic of reciprocity, the idea that we should treat others as we would like to be treated by them. These two ideas together laid the foundations for justice, that everyone has the right to be fairly treated, and no one should be penalized until their crime is proven. Likewise, the methods and principles of scientific discourse were foundational to the creation of our modern democracy. We all have the capacity to reason, and everyone deserves a hearing. I've also discussed the Italian Renaissance, when the ancient Greek ideals were revived and science progressed once more, and the Scottish Enlightenment, where people encouraged each other to see the world confidently and with fresh eyes to form new ways of understanding and representing it, and of teaching and communicating what they had learned. Both of these periods represented great liberations for society and great advances for science. The Enlightenments of the past did not begin in the most powerful countries. Greece was a tiny country, constantly threatened from the east and the north. Scotland was a modest neighbor of England. What they had in common was a sense among their people that this was their moment. They were countries that grasped an opportunity to become centers for reason and for progress. They had the courage to shape themselves and the future, and we are all still feeling the impact. It is tempting to draw parallels between 18th century Scotland, one step removed from its powerful colonial neighbor, and today's Canada, which, compared to the modern Rome to its south, feels like a haven of civilization. Canada has a great many advantages. Space, both geographical and intellectual. Strong public education and healthcare systems. A peaceful, tolerant, and diverse society. A stable economy. And phenomenal natural resources. It is internationally renowned as a friendly and peaceful nation and widely appreciated for its collaborative spirit and for the modest, practical character of its people. There are many other countries and places in the world that hold similar promise as centers to hold the next great flowering of civilization on behalf of the planet. I can think of no better cause than for us to join together to make the 21st century unique as the era of the first global enlightenment. The history of physics traces back to the dawn of human civilization. It is a story of how we have steadily realized our capacity to discover nature's deep secrets and to build the understanding and the technologies that lay the basis for society's progress. Again and again, our efforts have revealed the fundamental beauty and simplicity of the universe. There is no sign of any slowdown in the growth of our knowledge. And what lies on the horizon today is every bit as thrilling as anything we have discovered in the past. Today we have many advantages over the scientists of earlier times. There are 7 billion minds on the planet, mostly those of young people in aspiring, developing countries. The internet is connecting us all, providing instant access to educational and scientific resources. We need to be more creative in the way we organize and promote science, and we need to allow more people to get involved. The world can become a hive of education, collaboration, and discussion. The entry of new cultures into the scientific community will be a vital source of energy and creativity. We are better placed, too, to understand our position in the cosmos. We have just mapped the entire visible universe and pieced together the story of its emergence from a tiny ball of light some 14 billion years ago. Likewise, we have detected the vacuum energy, which now dominates and sets the largest distance on which we will ever be able to see galaxies and stars. We've just discovered the Higgs particle, a manifestation of the vacuum we all live in, which was predicted by theorists half a century ago. And today, theory is poised to understand the Big Bang singularity on a scale so tiny that classical notions of space and time break down. We live in a world with many causes of unhappiness. In these lectures, I've compared one of these, the information overload from the digital revolution, with the ultraviolet catastrophe that signaled classical physics' demise at the start of the 20th century. One can draw further parallels with the selfish, individualistic behaviors that are the root cause of our environmental and financial crises. Within physics, I see the idea of a multiverse as a similarly fragmented perspective. For many of its advocates, it seems to represent a loss of confidence in the prospects for basic science. Yet I believe all of these crises will ultimately be helpful if they force us, like the quantum physicists, to remake our world in more holistic and far-sighted ways. Through a deeper appreciation of the universe, and our ability, our incredible ability, to comprehend it. Not just scientists, but everyone has much to gain. At a minimum, the magnificent cosmos provides some perspective on our parochial, human-created problems, be they social or political. Nature is organized in better ways from which we can learn. The love of nature can bring us together and help us to appreciate that we are part of something far greater than ourselves. The sense of belonging, responsibility, and common cause brings with it humility, compassion, and wisdom. Society has too often been content to live off the fruits of science without understanding it. Scientists have too often been happy to be left alone to do their science without thinking about why they are doing it. It is time to connect our science to our humanity, and in so doing, to raise the sights of both. If we can only link our intelligence to our hearts, the doors are wide open to a brighter future, to a more unified planet with more unified science, to quantum technologies that extend our perception, to breakthroughs allowing us to access and utilize energy more cleverly, and to travel in space that opens new worlds. What a privilege it is to be alive. Truly, we are faced with the opportunity of all time. Thank you.